Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nichtern on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern on May 28th.
I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Server Member Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Server Member Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Certainly a cause of sickness. Is the way we guard ourselves and the way we act in the world from this separated place. Mm-hmm. So that's why, again, going back to the beginning of this podcast, you do not need to be old to get any benefit from some of the incredible wisdom of the Tibetan culture. Hey everyone, Raghu. I'm back with David Silver. I don't even need to say his entire name because David is my podcast partner from many years, although now he does it more infrequently, shall we say. David, welcome.
Hi. It's nice to be here.
So this is probably, another edition of Just Ask the Experts. They'll tell you everything you don't need to know because they don't know anything. And they're but we know what we do know? We're completely dependent on our unknowing nature. It's good to get to an unknowing nature. So we do a little bit of investigation, but it's basically around our interests, which really do coincide, David and I. And in this particular case, I think the commonality is our appreciation for the philosophy and the perspective of Tibetan Buddhism, right?
Well, yeah, 100%. I mean, it's not the only thing, but when it is the thing, it's 100%. You know, in other words, if I go to anything Tibetan, I'm very satisfied by what the great teachers say. It's just so clear.
And, yeah, clear, Vajra-like, crystal,
yeah,
penetrating, yeah. So, but you know what, Dave, I found something. I thought I'd, do you ever hear of someone named Glenn H. Mullen? He's a Tibetan expert? Yeah.
No.
He wrote a book called Death and Dying in the Tibetan Tradition. But this is concisely, I think, why both of us really appreciate that tradition. This is from his book. Tibet had become one of the very few ancient cultures of the world to come into the present age intact, unaffected by the colonial era and the destruction of the great wars that have plagued the materialistic societies of the last two centuries. It is possible that this very ancient sentiment, coupled with the lofty spirituality that was poised in the hearts of the Tibetan Buddhist mystics on the roof of the world, may still today carry meaning to a planet at a crossroads of self-destruction and the dawning of a new renaissance. That seems concisely exactly what's been going on. You know, that what's happened. I mean, even His Holiness said, if there's something in our tradition of benefit to mankind, it's our responsibility to preserve it in the face of any obstacle. Spiritual culture is a thing that transcends race, national borders, and even time. Worldly culture, no matter how quaint, has no lasting value, but spiritual culture does. Therefore, those aspects of Tibetan culture, which were merely qualities of the time and place of old Tibet, need not be saved. That's pretty amazing. But if there are traditions that are truly beneficial to mankind now and in the future, we would be weak, foolish, and irresponsible to let them become lost or destroyed. I believe our ideas and methods for knowing the nature of the mind and cultivating the spirit belong to the category of what is useful to mankind. It does not belong to the Tibetans. We are merely its safekeepers. Therefore, I and my people are making every effort to see that these faces of our culture are not lost with the loss of Tibet as a nation. They must endure for our children and our children's children and those in the community of mankind who are able to benefit from them. I think this really says, I mean, you know, David and I have done a lot of podcasts and in our lives have spent a lot of time really connecting with so many different lamas and so much of the material that this really succinctly says what we believe to be a reality and how beneficial not without tremendous suffering that still goes on. This tradition has been so beneficial to us. No.
Yeah, I mean, what you said before about it being at the roof of the world—I've heard that expression. You know, I think everyone has. But when you said it, it just occurred to me that I never really put two and two together. That there was a culture that was pretty much unaffected. You know, I'm reading Lost Horizon right now.
I thought that was a movie.
Well, it was actually a book by James Hilton.
Oh, right. And then they made that movie.
The movie was a very, very good movie. But the book is as usual, more detailed. But one of the things that I noticed when I was reading it was that it's really about Westerners suddenly encountering Tibet. And Shangri-La and the lamas are very hip to what these Westerners can and can't sort of accept. But they, one of which is why we're here. We don't want to be here. We crash landed in a plane in the middle of Tibet near the Karoli Mountains, and just, you know, it was just a nightmare. And then they met these a chief lama being carried, as they are sometimes, in a canopied thing, and they picked them up and took them to the lamasery. Yeah, right. So they took them to the lamasery, and there they were hostile for a while, except one man who seemed to be more aligned. But what came out of it was that they began to understand that their culture, which was that of the Western colonials, because they were colonial diplomats or officials of the British and one American, and that they had no idea that what the the richness of this culture. In fact, they thought there were a bunch of barbarians, which is still, most unfortunately, the way most Westerners look at not just Tibet, but African countries and countries from all over the world that aren't America or Britain or France or Germany or Italy or whatever. And the idea that other cultures would have redeeming or redemptive cultures and methods of healing is still rather alien to the West. And, you know, you asked me to read this book, Raga, which I enjoyed reading some of it. It's called Intra-Dependence.
Oh, yeah, Intra.
By Dan Siegel.
Yeah.
And it's a very sort of heartfelt book, even though he's kind of a scientist, mm-hmm. Medical. But one of the things he says is that power and profit, PNP called it, have completely eradicated in the West the idea of the law of one and non-dualistic perceptions and emotions about the world around you. And he goes into great detail about this. And some of it is really fascinating because he says that human evolution is so much slower than cultural evolution that it is possible to both take on bad stuff and to redeem it and to change it.
Mm.
And therefore, those of us nowadays who are saying, oh my God, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's gone too far. The oceans are too warm. They didn't take any notice of it. There are horrible things going on all over the world, earthquakes and all this. What he's saying in the book is, yes, that is true. But if we were all able to understand what the Tibetans and indigenous shamans around the world, he has this word called consilience.
Yeah. I've never heard that word. Yeah,
nor me. It's actually a medical scientific term. It's very narrow. It means when two scientific methods come together rather than science and spirit. But in his case, because he's an enlightened and brilliant man, he says, no, the consilience is really between a non-dualistic way of looking at the world and a dualistic way of looking at the world, and that we are fighting a battle with those members of the race or the species that believe that they talk about being, Christians and Jews and Muslims and all of that, but they're incredibly, the whole society, the whole system is very materialistic and is based on individual endeavor, and it's encouraged. Another thing he says is that unlike in Tibet or in devotional regions of the world, we are taught to be individually successful.
Mm.
And that sounds like, American exceptionalism, what's wrong with that? We make better chips. Biden says we're going to make chips in this country instead of China, and why we invented it, we should make them here. He's talking about a way of life which says that if you are not individually, separately successful, that you're not successful. In other words, binding yourself with the rest of the world, it's just so obvious when you think about it. Unfortunately, what he does say is that it is sort of a battle that, we have to individually find that. And then there's some chance that that will spread, And that makes sense because, as he says, neurological change is plastic. We can change the way our brains think, and therefore we can change the way we manifest that by speaking or acting in a way which is for the community of man and woman and animal and plant and insect. And literally everything. So if all is one, you can't really separate it out so as you can fight with it. There is no other. And that's what I think the Tibetans have been teaching us. And what's so great about His Holiness is, I have this thing, I think it's called the Book of Happiness or something, and it's a daily diary, So on any day, it's a piece of his writing. And today, I read it every morning if I can. I miss a day or two sometimes. But, this morning, the piece for April 2nd, any April 2nd in any year for this book, he says, don't get the stupid idea that people who are successful are happy and the people who are unsuccessful are unhappy. Dalai Lama says, people who are hugely successful are usually unhappy. Hmm. Why? Because striving for more and more and more success leaves you with no room, no space to just think of your fellow man and to be observant of a gentle and embracing non-dual approach to life. And so the Tibetan masters that we've come across, Raghu, have been instrumental in kind of changing our, just our everyday way of looking at things, you know. I mean, yesterday I was getting, the cable guy came and he was 4 hours late. 4 friggin' hours late. And we had to call the company and then they had to call him and his van and he was lost and whatever. And it's like Ram Dass talking about you don't know yourself until you're in the grocery line behind someone who's annoying you. We just were sitting here going crazy. Like, we want to do other things besides wait for the cable guy. But eventually he called me. He was a Russian. And he said, oh, I'm very sorry. I got in the wrong place driving and I'm going to be late. He was already very late. And, you know, I think at a certain point in my life, I probably would have said, what the? I mean, this is your job. Come here. I didn't. I said, no problem. This was after 4 hours of cursing, by the way. Okay. Cursing. And but fortunately, I just cursed to my partner, not to the world. You know, this business of blame and hatred and separation and division is all bound up in a way of looking at life, which has been heavily conditioned by materialism and competition, and the glorification of the individual, and the non-even observance of the idea that the entire thing is our property. And it lives within us. So why are we ignoring it? And to the exclusion of any kind of enlightenment or semi-enlightenment or anything, we're more interested in, you know, whether someone's going to get punished for a crime or whether stocks are going down or whether our IRA is going away. And I mean, I understand this. It makes sense that we should be worried about the world we live in, but it's strangling us.
Yeah. What, you know, when you talk about... this book that we both, you know, and I did a podcast on Mind Rolling with Dan Siegel, Dr. Dan. And, you know, it's of high interest for all of us, the idea that we live in this separate bubble and we are really identified with it to the detriment of our own potential for progressing into a being that is going to be a little bit more kind, a little bit more compassionate, as holiness says, kindness is my only religion, a little bit less judgmental, and so on. And everyone has that goodness in them, and allowing it to be, it gets really problematic when you're confronted by this severe attachment that we have to our individual bubble, to the me. And I pose this. I think you have some quotes that you picked up that you sent me, actually, David. Really? Things that, you know, were interest around the around death and dying, around consciousness. And I think around, particularly around the process of death. And by the way, everybody out there's listening to this who's, you know, under 50 or whatever, going, what do I, well, 50, maybe not, 40, maybe, yeah. You know, why do I listen to this bullshit? I mean, I'm not, you know, this is not in my path right now. I'll worry about that later, which is another natural human thing to do.
Yes.
Except the reality is that thing that we're talking about that we all are going to face is happening on a moment-to-moment basis. The liminal states that we move, you know, we don't know what's happening, and we're moving into a state from one state to another, and, you know, we're getting lost. We're getting chaotic, which leads us to hold on even tighter. And causes further problems. And so the essence of it is no different from somebody who has, you know, a terminal disease or a long-term disease that is affecting every notion of what you think you are. Mm-hmm. You know, it affects all the role that you think of, the identities that have been built up for all these years. So tackling that at any stage of the game, I don't care if you're 20, having that in mind through, first, obviously, you have to realize that there is a path to transform oneself. And once you set yourself on that path, because you were just so damn unhappy before, which is my case, and most people's cases, some people, like Dan in this book, he fell off a horse and his foot hung in the stirrup. And he was bumped along for 100 yards. I mean, that he survived it is a miracle. But that changed his life. It's funny, you know, and he recalls it. He went into a deep state of unity, and there was no I. And he, as it happened, you know, it lasted for a day, but it changed his life. You know, just absolutely amazing. And so the potential is there for all of us, and it usually does come through suffering, that we start to wake up and we start to look at our selfish behavior, our motivations, which, you know, the beauty of mindfulness holds for us in that respect.
I just wanted to make a point about something you said. You know, that if you're under a certain age, probably this is going to be, you know, well, why should I care about this right now? Well, you should, because, and this is from the CMAJJMEC, which is the Canadian Medical Association Journal, which is respected. And
of course, it's Canadian.
That's right. And there are 4 or 5 doctors who are involved in this, but they say, it is important to examine people's trajectories throughout the course of life to identify predictors and possible areas for intervention in the dying process. And what they're saying is that the way that the medical profession now, apart from those that are visionary or incredibly advanced, does not really do that. I mean, it doesn't help people through their life, you know? Whereas in cultures where there were people, young people, old people, married people, non-married people, together as communities, and they could see each other's progressions, so that the young ones could see the death of a grandfather or a great-grandfather. All of these trajectories are not ours anymore. So we don't actually look at someone who's dying unless we can help it. I mean, it's just, you know, we go to the hospice and say, oh, I'm so sorry. And then if you look at Facebook or anything, every time someone dies, it's like, oh, that's so awful. That's terrible. That is a manifestation of a distorted way of looking at the flow of life and death, as it were. I mean, it just is. So what they're saying here, these doctors, is from omitting death and dying from positive models of aging, the opportunity to make the processes of dying as successful as possible is missed. Making the best of dying does not necessarily mean staving off death at all costs, but finding the means through which positive mental and physical states can be fostered. For older adults, decisions made in the absence of acknowledging trajectories of death and dying can be misguided. Yeah, actually misguided and unrealistic. So basically, this word deathlessness became a word in my life a few years ago. And it wasn't there before. And it's inherent in many mantras, both on the Tibetan tradition and the Bhakti tradition. And, you know, I'll just give you an example, because I made a couple of notes on this. Some of them are very long, so let's just try a shorter one. Pardon this, I don't have them in order. This is Chögyal Rinpoche, who is not someone that I know anything about, but I know he's respected Lama. He says, he's talking about Yamantaka.
God of death.
Yes. And he says it means one by whom by nature subdues Yama, the god of death. Yama, the god of death, represents time, conceptualized mind, especially the state of mind where there are concepts of time and space, of the 5 elements, all concepts of vastness, infiniteness, great space, and all states where mind clings to these concepts. Taka is fully awakened, enlightened awareness, the antidote for Yama. And, I mean, that's a heavy statement, because he's saying, or it's a light statement, really. He's saying, even if you think that you've got it by saying, oh, it's vast, death is vast, the universe is vast, the metaverse is vast, the multiverse is vast, and I'm going into it, he's going, no, no, no. No, that's not going to work for you, because you have no idea what that means. And even if you did have an AI, that isn't what he's talking about. The Yamantaka is the defeat of conceptual, objectified, dualistic clinging to this life, which is not surprising, but unless you actually do some practice of some kind, it's by the time you die, you just are not prepared for it. I mean, it's that simple. It's that cruel. And I mean, I've come across this so many times. A friend of mine died about 7 years ago who had no spiritual disciplines whatsoever and didn't want any. But when he got, when he was dying, he actually called me and said, I need something. And I said, well, listen to the Giotto monks. He didn't know anything about that. So I gave them to him and he listened to them for a few days. And then I gave him a little Buddha. And I think I gave him a little statue. And when he was in the hospice, he had the statue there and he was listening to that music, to those chants, for about a few weeks before he went. And the last time I saw him, he was quite peaceful. Now, this is not supposed to be a self-congratulatory statement. I felt really bad for him. I don't know. I felt like he needed something that he knew he wanted. In other words, if you don't know you want it, there's no point in trying it. You know, it's not going to work. People are going to go, oh, yeah, that's nice, thanks. I did that once in 68. I heard that from someone recently. You know, oh, meditation, yeah, I tried that. Yeah, I did TM. And I'm like, oh, so how long did you do it for? Well, a long time, 8 months or something. And how long ago was that? Oh, 46 years ago. It just doesn't work like that. It's like anything else. If you want to play an instrument, you have to learn how to play it. If you want to be in an orchestra, you have to learn how to be in an orchestra. It requires rehearsal and someone helping you with that trajectory of knowledge, of self-awareness, so that when you come to the point where death can be defeated by deathlessness, what does that mean? What does it really mean, that? And again, the Tibetans are saying it's just a flow that has there's no barrier between one and the next. I mean, I asked Ram Dass once, I actually asked him, I said, the moment of death, what is that? And he said, the moment. And that was a period at the end of that word. He didn't go on about it. He said, the moment. It's like a moment like any other moment, and nothing dies. It just changes. Leary said to me, when I asked him, Timothy Leary, God, am I name dropping here? Those two guys. You know, he was dying. He had a couple of weeks left. And off camera, because I was filming him, for some reason I didn't film this, I asked him, are you worried about dying? And he had advanced cancer and he was going to die soon. It was obvious. I used to carry him to the bathroom. He was so light. He weighed like 80 pounds or something. It was unbelievable. Like a skeleton. And he said, no, David, no, it's an adventure. I don't know anything about what it's going to be, but what a thought that I'm going to go into an adventure, into the mystery. It's an adventure. I can't wait. And you know, he was sincere. That wasn't some kind of bravura. Or bravado, whatever the word is. He wanted to go there because he knew that that was going to be a change that he needed and wanted at this moment, that his incarnational journey was at this point, and he was happy about it.
Yeah.
I don't know whether any of that means anything. But,
courage. Yeah. Cœur in French, definitely.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking, there's a couple of people that I really respect, so do you. Both of them that I knew. I'm not sure you knew Stephen Levine, but...
No, I didn't. I know who he is.
Yeah. Sure. And the others is Roshi Joan Halifax, both of who have been very instrumental in giving a perspective on this whole process. And again, not just for the last year or 2 years of one's life. We're talking about a whole lifetime. This perspective is so incredibly valuable. So talking about deathlessness, here's something from Stephen. To open to our original nature, to the truth of being, we must stop postponing death. To take death, which allows us to go beyond death, beyond what we imagine dies, to come to that vastness of being that a being that many speak of as the deathless vastness of being, using death as a way of confronting ourselves with the places we hide, the places we disallow the heart. That's beautiful too. We are each in a process of awakening, becoming fully born so that we may die each moment past our fear and isolation. The illusion of separateness dies to reveal the deathlessness of our essential nature. That's well said. He was a great poet too, by the way, Stephen.
Yeah, I've never heard it put like that, but I mean, yeah, that's fantastic. I should read more of him. You know, his wife also is very amazing.
Andre,
Andre has...
This is from both this book, by the way, we'll have this in the show notes, because these couple of books are, you know, we're talking about the Tibetan Buddhist perspective, and of course the books and the scriptures that they have to allow us to understand about going into bardos. The best, in my mind, being the Sogyal Rinpoche's The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, which essentially comes from the Tibetan Book of the Dead. But Stephen and Andrea wrote a book, Who Dies? That is, we'll connect you up with that book. And Roshi wrote a book, Joan Halifax, Being with Dying, which is really good to get people aware of the processes that are something that comes to everybody at one point in their life or another. And I don't mean, of course, yes, we are all going to face our own moving into that bardo, into the mystery. But at the same time, we are going to be with people who need us. Like, you know, you just talked about David and that phone call, just one person, you know. And we've all had moments with, of course, family members and friends. And so, yeah, there's some great things in both of these books, which we'll have up there.
The other, yeah, everything you said... So true. This thing I sent you from Dhammapada 21 takes a slightly different tack, because he says, it says in there, mindfulness is the path to the deathless. Heedlessness is the path to death. The mindful do not die, but the heedless are as if dead already. And that's a harsh statement, because basically it says that if you're not mindful through the flow of your earthly life in the incarnation you're currently aware of, in other words, in his word, heedless, that will bring death and its fury. Whereas a mindful approach to the totality, not just you, but the totality, and a conscious, you know, sort of rehearsing that all the time of going back to it from separation, which happens all the time. I mean, all the time. We have 50,000 thoughts, a day, something like that, some ridiculous number. And no matter what we do, those thoughts come flowing through. And, you know, a lot of those thoughts are very negative. Are like, oh, God, I'm ill. Oh, God, I'm going to die. Oh, my friend's going to die. Oh, my God, my leg's going to get chopped off. Now, if you're in a war and somebody shoots you and you've got, like, approximately 30 seconds to appreciate what's happening, and then you die with a hole in your heart, what happens then? That fascinates me, because that's still someone's karma. Someone's karma was to be in one of those trenches. If you've seen All Quiet on the Western Front, won a lot of Oscars this year, rightly so. It's really? A horrifying,
I haven't seen it.
It's a stupefying movie. It's really? Horrible. It's just, I've never seen anything so graphic ever, and I could hardly watch it. But what it was about really was, this is the only way we can tell you how terrible this thing is called war that you admire so much with your military parades and your uniforms and your medals and your nonsense. And so that's heedless, because it's totally heedless, it's societally heedless, because it kills people before they have a chance. I mean, people who fight in wars are between the age of 18 and 23 usually. They're not our age. We're gone. They don't want us. We can't run fast enough. So war is about young people getting mutilated, murdered, massacred. And so in the Dhammapada thing, he's saying that war, he's not saying this, but I'm saying is that war is heedless, division is heedless, overwhelming individuated capitalism is heedless. Diabolical ideological communism and fascism is heedless, and they're all upon us right now. They are, whether you like it or not, they are. I've been a student of politics and geopolitics for at least 50 years, and I've never, ever seen anything like this. So what do we do? And Dan Siegel is very good about this too in the book, Intricate. We should just talk about that in a minute. You know, these are two sides of the same coin, deathlessness and intraconnection. He makes this statement that there are three things. I want to get this right because I know you had him on the show, but he's not on this show, so he can't correct me. but I want to just say what he said. He said, me is inner. We is inter. Mui is intra.
I love that.
So he made up this word, mui, which is almost impossible to say. But it's also almost impossible to do, you know. So interconnection is not enough for Dr. Siegel, because what he's saying is that, well, that suggests a separation. You know, that we're interconnected means we have mutual objectives and we have mutual likes and dislikes and we can be interconnected. He's saying, no, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about intraconnection, which is deeper and inner. And so that's the side of the coin that says the trajectory, again, back to that word, the trajectory of how you live will determine how you approach deathlessness and whether you actually reach for that. Because, I mean, basically, all these Tibetan masters are very, I mean, His Holiness is very pragmatic in his speaking. Now, I happened to hear yesterday His Holiness with a bunch of monks somewhere singing. I'd never heard him chant like this. And it was beyond the beyond the beyond. You could hear them in the background doing the call and response. But his voice was so incredibly potent. I've never heard anything like it. It was like a constant explosion of the deepest kind of expression of a human being. That was His Holiness. And yet, when he talks to us here, or anybody actually, I think anywhere, he's very down to earth, you know.
Totally.
He says, you know, if you can't swap romantic compassion for deep, universal compassion, you're going to have a hard time, whether you think it or not. Because one is not permanent. Nothing is permanent. So if you're going to base your life on impermanence, you have to come up with some way of dealing with that. You have to. Otherwise, it'll drive you crazy. You know, you just go, nothing is here. We're all just ghosts.
And the machine.
Right.
Remember that?
Yes.
That's so cool.
The ghost in the machine is this thing in our head that tells us we are the skin encased body that is most unfortunately, going to fall to pieces at a certain point in our life. And, you know, just go to pieces. And Pema Chodron's been good on that one, you know, which is when everything goes off, what do you do then? You know, I mean, I just recently had an experience where my dear pet cat, who's named after Padmasambhava, she fell and tore her ACL in her back left leg and was crying for days until we were able to sedate her and then treat her. And in that moment, in those moments when that was happening, I was in an extreme state of anxiety. I didn't sleep for two nights because she was crying all night and had to deal with it. It's nothing worse than an animal being sick because they can't tell you anything and it makes you crazy, you know. So, I had to absolutely envelop this animal with my love and my knowledge of just what it is and the whole damn thing. I had to forget everything and just do that for a little 10-year-old calico cat. And I felt all kinds of emotions that were not as good as this podcast. In other words, they weren't all, well, it's okay if she dies. I was absolutely freaked out that she couldn't walk anymore. She was doing odd things. She was walking backwards. Walking backwards. To see an animal walk backwards is like something from a horror film. Yeah. And she did that until I picked her up and put her on the bed and said, don't do that. And it's just been part of my life for the past few, it's been 3 weeks now of this. And it's taught me a lot of lessons. That to divide yourself even from an animal, is wrong. That's what's causing all the trouble, isn't it? I mean, let's get down to it. What is causing all the trouble? You know, Trump is going to get indicted tomorrow. A lot of people are very happy about that. A lot of people are not very happy about that. So it's not like that indictment of that criminal, he is a criminal, and I don't care what anybody thinks about that, he's a criminal. It doesn't help to hate him. It doesn't help. It just doesn't help. It's the immediate emotion that you want to have about someone who's doing other people, making other people suffer. Hitler, Mussolini, Pol Pot, you know, Idi Amin. These are people we tend not to think about, but they're the actual quintessence of division. They live to divide and conquer. That's the expression, and that's where it comes from. You divide and conquer, and that's what's going on. They're so how in, do you fight? You know,
yeah, they're in that me separated bubble.
Exactly.
There is no whatsoever. There's absolutely no recompense around the fact that we are connected. There's just no awareness, nothing. And because they're in that bubble, which is enhanced by power and wealth and fostering division, it's unfortunate. It's why Ram Dass used to have a picture of in this, you know, many different political figures who were lost in this separateness and didn't have any kind of kindness. He would say, poor, lousy incarnation, but I'm going to relate to that which is behind all of that. Ram Dass called it soul. You know, the Buddhists would call it Buddha mind. And he didn't want to spend his time hating, as you just said, as many of us do when we see these kinds of injustices. I want to just turn for a second, Dave, back to these couple of people that I really love, Stephen and Andrea and Roshi, who really have something to say about how to, you know, of course, they also point to the separation as the fundamental issue, as Dan does in his book, Dan Siegel, as a fundamental issue which creates the kind of polarization is the belief in this separate entity that we feel we are through our, it starts with getting a name, it continues with all of the ways in which we continually are forced to identify ourselves, which is why indigenous people and their wisdom so important now, because they have rituals that address this all the way through a young person's life. And that is, it's just lost for us. We really don't have that, you know. We have a bar mitzvah, we have a communion or whatever. We have these things that are not, they are not substantial to us at all. We've lost a connection to them where it has real meaning. One thing that I love, I don't know if you've ever heard Roshi's aphorism around strong back, soft front. She says, all too often, our so-called strength comes from fear, not love. And this is what we're talking about with people, aforementioned people that are living in this separate universe. The strength comes from fear, obviously not love. If there was love, they would be caring about other people. Instead of having a strong back, many of us have a defended front shielding a weak spine. Have you ever heard it? She talks about this all the time.
No,
in other words, we walk around brittle and defensive, trying to conceal our lack of confidence. And then, you know, when you read something like that and you identify it in a person, in this case like Trump, you may start to have a little bit of compassion because you see that, you can see that is what's going on, you know. If we strengthen our backs, metaphorically speaking, and develop a spine that's flexible but sturdy, then we can risk having a front that's soft and open, representing choiceless compassion. The place in your body where these two meet, strong back and soft front, is the brave, tender ground in which to root our caring deeply when we begin the process of being with dying. Mm. How well said is that? I mean,
it's perfect.
Talk about appropriate advice or even a perspective and view from her in relation to how we guard ourselves, right? And with tremendous defense mechanisms. And our body reacts like that as well, which is why, you know, certainly a cause of sickness is the way we guard ourselves and the way we act in the world from this separated place. Mm-hmm. So that's why, again, going back to the beginning of this podcast, you do not need to be old to get any benefit from some of the incredible wisdom of the Tibetan culture and the wisdom of others who have followed in those footsteps and taken teachings and translated them, like Roshi Halifax in particular. The vast usefulness at any age of starting to understand how that separate bubble affects so much, all, you know, of course, right around us, and it affects so much. You see it in the world with what's going on in our country and in other countries, and the wars that are, how they're shaping this separateness, and you know, it's undermining the reality of what Dan is talking about in terms of interconnection, right? And you know, there's one thing in that book that he said that I really loved, which was, it's not like you give up being a separate person with an identity and work to do, taking care of family, paying the bills, all of it. You don't give that up. You are behind that, understanding its function. I mean, Ram Dass put it, well, he didn't say this, but whatever, it's a metaphor that comes from some teaching in the past. The ego is a great servant, but a terrible master. And that's really what Dan is alluding to when he talks about, you don't give this up, and you know, as if it's like that whole crazy bullshit idea of what surrender. We have no idea what surrender is. It's not surrendering your thing and your money and your being to another something. It's nothing to do with that. It's surrendering that phony I, that separation bubble. And surrendering it means realizing that we are in it and how that is causing so much of the issues that we have in this world today, not to mention the reality of, in terms of internally, not being able to make friends with moving along in this life, which includes getting sick and dying. She says, death is inescapable. All beings, you and me, are heading straight into its mouth.
Yes.
What kind of optimism can be born from such a raw truth? And Jonas Salk, right, a famous guy who invented, what did he, you know, some
polio vaccine.
Cure of polio, yeah. He said, learn to cooperate with the inevitable. How about that for a good say? Simple, but not easy. Can we hold such moments without a sense of tragedy, frustration, or fear? I, for one, don't find it easy. I have a basic intolerance of suffering, but I give it my close attention while holding myself as open as possible. I mean, what more simple way to say that truth? You know?
Yeah. I'm looking at this quote I sent you by Rumi.
Which?
He says,
we love Rumi.
Which fits that. He says, goodbyes are only for those who love with their eyes. Because for those who love with their heart and soul, there is no such thing as separation. And we know that because when that happens, you know, when you know, we're so used to the external, and it's not evil. It's just natural that we're in this body. We look at other bodies. We make judgments. People do things. They don't do things. Whatever. We make judgments. But it's only after teaching from those that have gone way beyond that that can say to us, no, that's not going to work. To judge and to hate and to fight constantly and to be angry is clearly not going to help, you know. It just never does. So, you know, we need teachers. And I think even though the world is messed, it pretty much has been for a long time, shall we say, before prehistory, when all kinds of things happened that we have no idea about because they don't teach about, you know, they don't teach us about ancient civilizations where, you know, Rama and Sita were real people or where, you know, we're not told that. We're taught about wars and governments and nation states and all this separation to make us happy. I mean, when Prince Harry did that interview with them, or did the documentary,
yeah,
he said something that I actually myself had experienced, and I give him great plaudits for this. He said, I looked at a map, and it was all red, and it was the British Empire. And I realized, oh, my God, that's what we are. We're those people that ruled those people and enslaved them. And that's why he was ostracized, by the way, as part of his teaching, is that racism is evil. If anything is evil, it's racism and bigotry, okay. But what's so great is that people, I know people will probably who listen to this think, why the hell is he quoting Prince Harry? Because he's a human being, and he's got certain experiences which maybe you and I have not had. And one of them is being part of that system you talked about, Raga, the power and profit and colonialism and control. And yet, and you know this because I know you know it, there is a counterbalance going on in the world, which is extraordinary, because we know about it because of the internet and because of communications and technology, of basically people, young people who are fed up with this, just as we were fed up in the 60s with war and just nonsense. And so civil rights came about and the anti-war movement happened and it changed the world. Well, what's changing the world now are the Greta Thunbergs and so forth. I saw a strange thing, an interview with her, and one of the interviewers said to her, is it true that you were silent as a child? And I thought she'd go, no, that's just a silly rumor. And she said, no, that's absolutely true. Did you talk to your siblings? No. Why not? Because they were all talking about nonsense. It was all small talk. I couldn't get involved. I don't like that. The world is burning. And she knew that when she was a kid. So Greta now is what, in her 20s, I suppose? And now she's vegan and she does not fly anywhere. And for someone as world-renowned as her and as important as her, she's more important than any politician because she's actually telling us the truth. And she doesn't fly anymore because she found data that said that frequent flying all over the world, 50,000 flights a day in America, whatever it is just one of the worst polluters. So she's a woman of her word and of her soul. And that's the counterbalance, which is so encouraging. You know, that we're seeing all this horror show going on in Ukraine and so on. It's just awful. We know it is. But it's just a cycle. And while that cycle is going on, I think there are people waking up just as much. And in my estimation, more so now than ever, even though it's not as obvious. People are not, you know, wearing bell bottoms and long hair to tell people that they're different. They're not hippies anymore. But there are people who know this stuff and are practicing it. In other words, compassion, deep compassion, and the sort of leaving behind of the solo self, as Dan Siegel calls it. Good word. Solo self. The ego that is, if it's your master, it kills you. If it's your servant, it helps you. And I think a lot of people are there now. Because otherwise, we wouldn't be doing this. You and I would not be doing this. We don't want to waste our time, what's left. You know, it's like, why are we doing this? Well, we're doing it because there's an aura about it. There's a channeling that's going on with people who just want to be kind, as His Holiness says. They want to just make that and expand it out and be kind to yourself. Being kind to yourself means not ignoring suffering in yourself and in others. It just means, you know what it means? It means good cheer. I like that, those two expressions. Good cheer, because, you know, the soldiers in World War I in the trenches had to be humorous or they went crazy. And they just had to be. They joked around with each other because they knew that their death was imminent. And it was horrible. And yet they found the resources somehow to do that, to joke around and to, I mean, just to overcome it by whatever way they could. Now we're not in that situation here in America or in Ukraine. It's just a war, another war. But we can't let that destroy our purpose, which is, you know, which is about, what is it about? It's about kindness, and it's about not, it's about kindness, that's period. Because within that is everything. If you're kind, it means you're appreciating and being able to bring into your own consciousness that of others, other cultures, other ways, other people. Some people who you don't like, but maybe they got a point sometimes. And it sounds so preachy, so I'm going to stop this. I'm stopping this. The world sucks. but there are signs. There are signs that more people than ever are chanting, more people are doing yoga, more people are doing Tai Chi, more people are using acupuncture instead of drugs. I mean, it is happening. It's been happening for 50 years.
Or let's even forget all the spiritual blah, blah. How about, I just saw something today. I saw a man who was a specialist in rehabbing people from physical injuries, but not just physical injuries, but also people... dementia, et cetera, and using it through physical action. And he went and he devoted, I'm not sure, all his time. Maybe it wasn't all his time, but a significant amount of his time. And it showed you in the video how he was working with disabled children, working with older people who were in all sorts of, you know, compromised conditions. And he just gave. He totally was, you just see the giving that he was doing. It was just, never mind the reality when you talk about it and everyone goes, well, that's fantastic. When you actually see him, the way that he gave from his core of goodness was, it was astounding. So you're right. There are people who are just doing it. They're not thinking about it. They're not thinking about the philosophy that, well, I'm going to get myself out of this separate bubble because, you know, I'm hurting myself and I'm hurting everybody else. It's just coming from a place of knee-jerk reaction to doing it. There is a lot more of that. And they're not, you know, they're not necessarily on any particular path or spiritual path or religious path or anything. So I would say that, yeah, it's extraordinary promising. I have, before we go, though, there was one other thing that I got. Who's this from? Stephen Levine. That really helps to address, and it covers both. It does address the separateness that we've been talking about and are lost, how lost we are in it. And we don't have to be somebody who's in a power position, you know, can be at a company, at a government, whatever. It doesn't have to be that for this to speak to us, because we're talking about we do this within ourselves. We do this to ourselves. Just think of how you talk to yourself sometime. So there's a lot of judging going on. There's a lot of discomfort with ourselves because of this complete identity with being separate. I mean, it's as soon as the mind's conditioning to be someone arises, right? That's the first thing. You get a name, you're going to be someone. A kind of pain comes into our heart, a feeling of being alone. I did this thing, you know, I think I've told you, Duncan Trussell and I have been working on this movie of me, Krishnadas, this whole thing about that we wake up in the morning. And we're the producer, the director, the writer. We write our own reviews and do the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And so we've been working on it. And in the work that, you know, just doing this that you and I are doing, we started identifying the pain of growing up into this separation entity bubble. And you know, Stephen, a feeling of being alone was so prevalent as we, you know, revealed to ourselves and each other the kinds of things that, that really fed this this separation, this feeling of being alone. It was really miserable. It is the loneliness of our separateness, our alienation from the universal. But when we sit quietly with that loneliness and let it float in the mind, it dissolves into a quote-unquote aloneness, which is not lonely. This is a big teaching, or, you know, teaching. That's too pompous. This is great information, okay? Aloneness, it's an aloneness which is not lonely when you can sit quietly with this feeling of separation and alienation, but is rather a recognition that we are each alone in the one. It is the great silence of the universe, quote-unquote, alone in space. It has a wholeness about it. But to change the intense loneliness of our personal isolation into a quote-unquote aloneness with God, we must gently let go of control and stop recreating the imagined self. We must surrender our specialness, our competition, our comparing minds. Control is our attempt to make the world align with our personal desires. Right? Rings all the bells there? To let go of control is to go beyond the personal and merge with the universal. Control creates bondage. Control is the defender of the clinging mind. It opposes the openness of the heart. If our boats are empty, though there is still a vessel carried by the prevailing winds and currents, there is not, quote unquote, someone in it to be misunderstood. There is no one to oppose. There is simply empty space, boat, water, wind. Everything is in perfect harmony. Nothing is pulling against the natural flow. No one in the boat. No one to suffer. The analogy, by the way, that he talked about is that famous story is you're in a boat and it's foggy and you see another boat, and through the fog and everything you imagine there's a person, maybe a malevolent kind of a person, that's coming at you, and you know, you create all this imagination when there's nothing. Absolutely, it's just projection, you know. Anyhow, there's some really beautiful, this thing around converting and transforming loneliness and separation into aloneness with God is just fantastic, I think.
Yeah, oh, that's, yes. I mean, I mentioned to you the other day that I finally caught up with this Octopus, My Teacher film on Netflix. And I'd sort of resisted it for some reason, mainly because everybody liked it. I'm such a contrary sort of person. And I thought, well, you know, okay. I watched it, and I was overwhelmed by it. I literally was overwhelmed by it. Because at the end of the film, and I don't care if this spoils the film for you, because this is the truth of the film. It's not a thriller, you know. It's not a whodunit. The man who is diving on the South Cape of Africa has done that his whole life, and then he became neurotic and unhappy and basically was suicidal, really. And then he started diving again, and he comes into contact with the octopus. I won't tell you the whole story, but one thing at the end is this. Octopuses, I didn't know this, live very short lives. A year. I thought that was just for, like, butterflies and flies and things, but an octopus, which is an extraordinarily advanced creature, only lives a year.
Yeah.
And there's a moment at the end of the film when the octopus is being constantly chased by this shark, who's not a bad being. It's just that sharks eat
nature.
You know, that's it. That's the deal. And there's just a moment when they're underwater and he loses he goes to find the octopus. It had gone away. It had been chased, as I remember. And then he's just there underwater, and the creature comes to him and lies on his chest, and he holds it like a baby. Mm. And it's an octopus. And my heart just just, I couldn't believe what I was seeing, because it was the perfect, what D.S. Eliot, the poet, called objective correlative. And what he meant by that was that there are certain things that happen in life that stand for everything. You just need that one vision sometimes to tell you what Raghu just read, which is so, and the other stuff from Roshi and from Stephen Andre and all these amazingly conscious and kind and giving souls who want to teach us how to be happy, actually, in a way, that this little thing of seeing this octopus clinging to him, a human, a big human, was just overwhelming to me, because it just said everything. It said what we've been talking about for the last hour or whatever. And Raghu and I do not talk from a position, or we try not to talk from a position. We know this and you don't know. We're all trying. And, you know, when I come across, well, on one level is the Mahasiddhas and the Gurus, which very few of us actually meet. You did, others did. But you don't actually need that. You need self-awareness. You need the trigger that gets you to do what was in that last piece you wrote, which is to make a really, really clear distinction between aloneness and loneliness. Mm. Because what else are we going to do? I mean, you know, it's a way to progress, is to see that we are not alone, actually. And we have it all within us. You know, it's just, it's all there. The inner life is all there for us.
Yep.
And it just needs triggering. Needs to be taught to us.
Yeah.
And we need to know.
You see this movie, you know, what's it, My Octopus Teacher, I think.
Yes,
is the name
that's
of it.
That's
the name. Yeah, that's just, it opens up a whole door. In fact, you know who told us at a retreat that she was teaching at with us in Maui with Ram Dass a number of years ago? Roshi Halifax said, they have been doing experiments at Johns Hopkins or one of the big schools around the level of intelligence of octopuses. Mm. Don't eat them.
No, oh, yeah.
I have I was in a fish restaurant the other night, which that's a whole other thing, trying to get out of, you know, vegetarianism. And I see the octopus there and I shudder, and then I think I'm doing the same thing. You know, we're all going through all this stuff. It's very difficult.
Yes,
very difficult.
See the calamari there? Even the word is beautiful. It's like a lovely resort in Sicily or something. Yeah. Calamari. But then you think this is a being that has just as much sophistication in its environment as we do. More, in fact.
No,
more.
Feeling because, and the whole thing. It's
you know,
so
we're alienated from our environment on the whole, you know. Yeah. And you know, when the Russian cable guy came into my place yesterday, he didn't know too much about what he was doing for whatever reason, because it was difficult. he was a really nice guy. And then he looked out of the window, and I have an amazing view here of the river.
Yeah.
And he just, and it all dropped from him. Oh. Instead of being the cable guy, he just looked at me and he said, "What a view. What a view that is. Oh, I love that view." And I looked in his eyes, and there was something there that was just not there 5 seconds before. Mm. It was just love for this nature, you know, that he saw.
And you're in common totality.
Yes, yes, yes.
In that
moment. Mean, yes. And you know, we've got to have a sense of humor about it. You know, our failings are our failings, and we can come to make them, we can heal them, but... Yeah. Healing is it can't start with anything but this, that we are all one, the law of one, as people are calling it, the law of one. We don't have to know it's a law, but we have to know that that's the ultimate truth.
It's the law of the cable guy, actually.
It's the law of the cable guy. It actually is, you know, that, you know, and you know, the reason people are upset in this country, I think, at this point, is that there's been a lot of weirdness on all ends of the spectrum, you know, people being cruel to other people. It's hard to imagine. I don't know anyone who's cruel to other people. Maybe they have cruel thoughts. But a lot of that is media. A lot of that is that other thing where they're making money from advertisements. Our friend Danny told me the other day that MSNBC, the progressive channel, loves to have Trump on there. they're the progressive channel. Why? Because their ratings shoot through roof when this character comes on. Because no matter what we think about him, he's a magnetic guy. And people are yearning for that. So even the liberals watching this television channel that tells them that Trump is a nightmare, they need him to keep the viewers watching. Now, what does that say about our culture? What it says is we need the guy to have the octopus on his chest, and we need Stephen.
Right.
We need the guy Stephen that, and Andre. You know, we need them.
Yeah, right.
And we need Bruce Springsteen. We need people who actually say to us in the most lovely ways and the most magnetic, the most, oh, what can you say? When Bruce sang that song, it's called Something of the Departed, Souls of the Departed, isn't it, David? That's the only song I think I've ever listened to by anybody that made me cry. I'm not a big crier. I'd love to cry. But when I heard Bruce singing that song, basically about veterans, I think, because he was so involved in that, and you feel the heart of Springsteen within that song, I just realized, oh, my God, Souls of the Departed. There's a pop singer saying that. Instead of saying Moon, June, Croon, he's saying, let's pray for the souls of the departed. Something's right if that can manifest in our culture.
No, there is something right, and you are absolutely right to take a nihilistic view that the people that are living in these separation bubbles are being fed by many other people who believe they are in separation bubbles and there is nothing else is not true, that is the majority. That is not the majority, and you see things all the time that show you people do care. So I'm going to end this show with a quote. Since you quoted Bruce, I want to quote Jimi Hendrix. And so castles made of sand slip into the sea eventually.
Yeah, right. The way he said that. He paused, right? He went, eventually.
Eventually. We are all, you know, we are those individual bubbles, and that's okay, as long as we understand we are part of that vast ocean. And, we're going to all return together. This is Mind Rolling on the Be Here Now Network. Thank you, David, so much for joining and
my pleasure.
Spending some time about some, I think, important subjects. And
I was going to say, Robbie, one thing, when we talk together, we do ramble around, but that's okay because it's stream of consciousness. But we go
well,
from
that. Well, no, we were pretty good.
We rambled. No, I don't mean ramble disparagingly, really. I just mean that's it's the way I like to. It's the way I like to converse, shall we say.
Yeah, it's what we do when we just talk. So
it's like a phone call. It's the same. And everybody needs to do that. But, you know, that's another thing about His Holiness. And then you see him talk to people and they're asking these abstruse questions. And he's always got these very simple, gentle answers. And he may be the wisest person on the earth.
Well, talk about Buddha of compassion. So, Dave, we'll do this again. Everybody, whatever references that we've had in these books, the people who do the show notes will have them up there. You'll have to let people know a couple of your sources as well. Just write a note, please. And we see you next week.
To you?
You can write to me. Oh, it's good.
Okay.
Please make that happen.
I'll make that happen. You're lonely.
See you later, everybody.
Bye.